Blog Talk Radio.
La la la.
welcome to the show. I think I see Rabble there waiting in the queue to see if I can master technology and get him on. Hello?
Hello.
What's happening? I made shit work.
Good job, man. Good job.
I appreciate that.
God.
Well, we want to welcome Rabble Rouser back from a crazy weekend at the G20. He just partied and got drunk, really. that's his business. I mean,
well, you know, being that I am friends with a market anarchist, I figured I'd go and support all the local business I could.
That's the way it is. I know you were just there to make money anyway. So
yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's what you do. So how are you? How you feeling?
I'm feeling like I just spent 4 days in a police state, which is a really odd feeling because I'm not in the police state directly. Not that we don't live in a police state, because we absolutely do, but it's strange the things that privilege allots us. I mean, here we are, 2 days ago, stepped into a completely militarized zone, and now I'm outside of that militarized zone, but I'm still in the same country, and I'm hearing and reading reports from people who weren't at the G20 telling me what happened there, and telling me, people like Alex Jones, telling people that there were less than 100 anarchists and that they all had police protection. Tell you what, Alex Jones, tell you what, bud, here's the deal. Why don't you come over to my house and we'll see how much police protection you're going to fucking need? Because I'm sick of people like Alex Jones. I'm sick of these rich, white, male, privileged assholes. And I'm sick of these liberals who cry out nonviolence when they're not at an action. Because I'll tell you, you're going to denounce things from the safety of your home, then you better understand that you're using nonviolence as an excuse not to act, as opposed to an action. So all around, though, I'm very pleased. I'm very overwhelmed with joy at the ability not only of the anarchist community to come together in such a beautiful fashion, but of the people of Pittsburgh. They were really fucking great. I've never received more high fives and offers of water and food and hugs from people in the neighborhoods that we were marching through that the police were indiscriminately gassing while they had their children outside playing. I've never received support like that before.
So, I mean, all around, were people, were the citizenry, were they talking to you? Were they talking about some of the stuff you're doing? I mean, what was kind
absolutely.
Of the general feeling? What was kind of the general feeling of a lot of the folks that you met that lived there? What was their reaction to all these corporate giants and these politicians, the power structure concentrating there?
Well, a lot of people didn't quite understand why their city was picked. They didn't quite understand what benefit it would give to them, and they definitely didn't appreciate the amount of police in their streets. They were angry about that. The most sympathetic that I could see to us, other than I want to give a big shout out to Bloomfield Sandwich Shop. Bloomfield Sandwich Shop, it's on Liberty Street. Anybody in Pittsburgh going to Pittsburgh, look up Bloomfield Sandwich Shop and go there. We went there 2 times in a row for breakfast. It's run by a couple great old hippies, Roz and Mike, and they put a big sign up in the window that says, G20 demonstrators, welcome here. They put all over the cafe, they had messages of solidarity and support with the people, the protesters and the people in jail. Great place. And they $2.29 for eggs, hash browns, toast, and coffee. I mean... What the fuck? Can't beat that.
Wow.
But the bus drivers were pissed because obviously their routes were completely messed up, and they weren't given previous notification that these things were going to happen either. And so you had bus drivers stuck in the middle of a riot. And then when I say riot, I'm talking more of a police riot than anything else. And police actually commandeered city buses to transport themselves around. Not only city buses as far as pay-to-ride buses, but school buses as well. I saw many school bus drivers, crouched inside their school buses on cell phones, scared to death because they were the forced transport for the armed military and police that were in the streets.
So was that, now is that kind of general vibe you were picking up from them, or did any, you know, were, did you hear any angry mutters?
Oh, absolutely. I heard a lot of University of Pitt students, most likely younger Pitt students, freshmen, making threatening and ridiculous statements to each other about the protesters, that they were going to punch us in the face and all this stuff. Meanwhile, the cops were tear gassing them and locking them down in their dorms for no reason. So,
you know, something I'm always curious about is, you know, I know in my experience, particularly with the anti-war movement in Portland and a couple of the marches that I've been on, gatherings of people, that sometimes there's kind of especially, you know, in this city, there's oftentimes it's not entirely clear who all is there. It's kind of a hodgepodge. So was there, I mean, did you find some of the kind of the, I hate to use the word, but some of the politics of something so large and people gathering? I mean, is there a lot of opposition amongst activists, so to speak, who are all kind of there for the same reasons? Or
not at the G20 for some reason. We were riding the bus, and there were two women behind us who were age 65, and they had been protesting since the Vietnam War. And generally in the past at the DNC and things, people of that age group and of that era of protest tend to denounce the young anarchists. These ladies were overwhelmed with excitement that we were there. And they saw us as their first, and this is in their lines, you are the first line of offense. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, you are the ones out there actually making the push to create change. And it was an amazing thing to hear her say. And she said, we're just so excited that there are people with energy and people with passion to go out there and stand up to these thugs. In the past, you know, Obama is Obama gets a big award for radicalizing a lot of liberals this week. Because Obama came out last week and said that he denounces the protesters and that the protests won't work. He said, to wrap up his words, he said that basically global capitalism is here and it's going to stay, and there's nothing a protest or the voice of the people can do about it. Get used to it. Adapt to it. And I have never seen more angry, radical liberals in my life. They were using the most flaming anarchist rhetoric that I've ever heard came out of the speeches of the liberal contingency there. They were talking about occupying the streets, full-on occupation. They were talking about disregarding all police orders. And these were over the loudspeakers. These were the liberal groups that were there organizing. So there was a lot less political infighting here than I've ever seen before. It seems that our movement is starting to fall less and less for divisive tactics and starting to understand, at least the people at the actions are starting to understand the idea of mutual respect and of diversity of tactics.
Wow. So, it could be kind of one of those things where, what it took was something like two consecutive massive transfers of power to the most powerful in the form of wealth. I tremble to say, well, not really, that, you know, people, you know, there's something to say. I think people have started to get hit in their pocketbooks and in their just general livelihood. You know, it's one of those things where I think it's really easy to ignore things that are going on to a certain degree, but when it really starts to directly hit you, and I'm not saying that I think that's in any way a shallow reason to get involved, because that tends to be what happens, you know, and we're buried in this system. But, I mean, do you think there's any truth to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that as one of the basic rules that we that are not rules, but basic ideas that I have about any kind of action that anybody's going to take is that the action should stem from a point of necessity. And what I mean by that is it should not stem from ideology. We shouldn't act in a manner that is uncomfortable just because ideology says that we should. Meaning, if you're a Democrat and you're towing the party line and you're voting for Obama just because he's a Democrat, even though you are staunchly against war, you are acting in a way that ideology tells you to act. If you are acting according to your heart, obviously you would vote against the war by voting for someone who was against war. So in vice, the same thing can be said for radical communities who want to act in a way that maybe they feel ideologically pressed into, but is not necessary in their daily lives. As the economy gets worse, as it's brought home, truthfully brought to your home, you begin to act out of necessity. And that's how liberation struggles tend to occur. A lot of times we don't understand, because of the massive amounts of confusion of the system, the great amount of money and resources and energy concentrated on distracting us and successfully doing so, along with the amount of energy that goes into making us unhealthy with our food, with our air conditions, with our work conditions. All of those things play into dumbing down a resistance. And as those layers tend to fall away and get taken away, you get to the core of it and you have nothing left to lose but everything to gain and everything to fight for. And I think people are starting to get to that point.
So here's the most important question is, and this is what goes into a professional radio show. Do I just click on start chat session to make sure the chat's open for all our listeners?
Yeah, you should have been clicked on that a long time ago.
Okay, log into chat as co-host?
No.
Does that matter?
Click on start chat.
Oh, word. All right, cool. I'm fucking running this shit. Okay, cool. I'm all by myself. And that's what happens when you, and I don't know if this is indicative of my position as a market anarchist, but you end up hosting radio shows alone with nobody or in chat.
Yeah, as far as market anarchism goes, I want to point out to our listening audience that the market anarchist co-host of the show is also the one enraptured in fantasy gaming. And I think that this is indicative of maybe a psychology here that we see boiling through. I don't want to get Freudian and put him on the couch, but I'm thinking anybody that believes in the rolling power of dice for elves to cast spells definitely could believe in money and the power of the market. So,
you know, I just want to go on record and say that, you know, I just pretend to be an elf. I don't believe I'm one. I won't kill
like
myself.
It's like pretending to be an anarchist.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, Thanksgiving. Hey-o.
Stephen Molyneux. Stephen Molyneux.
By the way, what a dick. He didn't even email me back when I canceled his spot. So.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah,
and by the way, that song at the beginning, that was the band Fire on Fire, their band Sirocco. It's if you listen to the lyrics, it's a highly anarchist song, and they're a fucking rad band. Did you get to hear the song at the beginning?
I did, and I've heard that song. You suggested that band to me a couple weeks ago, and I checked them out, and I really dug it. It's it's kind of like a more raw version of the Decemberists or Colin, whatever his name is, from the Decemberists solo stuff, like vocally and. It's good, though. The lyrics are
You know,
great.
One time a friend of mine, Colin Malloy, delivered him a pizza.
That's great.
Yeah, it's totally awesome. So let's talk about, like, practical things. So now you're back home, and after this experience, I mean, like, what's it like when you go to something like that, and this is that intense and that fucking violent, you know, and crazy? I mean, because I know you, and I know you got a sizable heart, so that... You know, like, how is it going from that and coming home? I mean, is coming home just the most cathartic thing ever and just being around your two awesome kids? And, I mean,
well,
does that really make – do those kind of experiences, do they help you really – you know, do your level of, you know, like, appreciation for your family unit and those closest to you? I mean, how does that – I mean, does it feed
they
it?
Do,
does
but,
it?
But I can't help but want to mention the amount of trauma that takes place in the streets there. And I know that, I'm going to lose my militant anarchist points here because I'm, you know, whatever. Whatever. It's a traumatic experience and for anybody to take part in. And I want to say that it's most likely a traumatic experience for the pigs as well. But they don't have to do it. That's
yeah,
the thing.
That
we
is
don't
the
have to be there unless we choose to fight back, because – that's the choice we're given, is either put up with this shit, put up with global capitalism, put up with the destruction of your planet, put up with the outsourcing of jobs, put up with the loss of life, put up with the economy, put up with authority, put up with false authority, put up with the police state, or show up and fight back. their choice is, you know, we're going to pay you overtime, and we're going to give you extra money, extra guns, and extra toys to go beat down fellow Americans or fellow humans in the streets just because they disagree with our policy.
Well, and it's, I always imagine that, too, is that, you know, I work at a place that's in, you know, it's in the neighborhood, and we have several officers that come in there, and one of them, this guy that is just, you know, I've been interacting with him for 3 years now, and, you know, I imagine when I think of him, because he's such a nice man to me on that level, just, yeah, and on that level, you know, I interact with him every day. He buys food, I serve him, and we talk about things, we just talk about mundane things, and, you know, it's such a crazy thing to imagine that there are. I think what's most frightening to me is, like, you know, the given is, I remember one time being downtown during the height of the anti-Iraq war movement and walking past one of the SWAT teams in the alleyway, you know, those fuckers. And
yeah.
I'll never forget this, the look on this guy's face. He looked like he was one of those fucking dickhead jocks from fucking high school who was such an asshole and was a cop now and could legally, quote unquote, legally inflict violence on people within an inch of their life and or kill them. And the look on his face as I looked at him, and I was very vocally talking, you know, with the person at the time about how much this was just all fucking bullshit, it's all a bunch of criminals. And I remember him hearing me and looking at me and grinning wickedly.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Just grinning wickedly. And,
yeah.
You know, there's those guys, but I expect those guys. You know, I expect those guys to be attracted to anything that will give them the chance to beat up on people. But it's the people that are, you know, like the fabled, you know, the good Nazi, or like these people with who I think are probably good people who voluntarily agree to take on a job in the interest of, you know, maybe in some of them it was some ideological thing. And, like, this plays into what you were talking about, this ideology, I think, of some that are, like, they're taking on a role of helping to protect their community and provide a service. And but where you have to go in your mind to skew that,
let me tell you this. The entire downtown Pittsburgh in the business and financial district was completely filled with fully armed pigs ready to kill.
Right.
We crossed a bridge into the bad neighborhood. As a march of 10,000 people together crossed the bridge through this bad neighborhood, not a single riot cop in that neighborhood protecting anybody's home, anybody's business, or any buildings whatsoever.
That is
also,
that's amazing.
Not a single bit of property destruction or disruption in those neighborhoods by the anarchists.
Right.
So,
who are they really protecting?
Hear. Fuck what
yeah.
they say.
Yeah, yeah.
They have their... They have their guns out protecting bank windows, and their guns are pointed at human beings.
That's, you know, one of the most searing images of the past year for me was seeing this documentary about the economic collapse in Argentina. And remember how we talked about, you know, the people going out with the pots and pans and such fucking awesome.
Talking about The Take, correct?
The what?
The Take, is that the film you're talking about?
Yeah, that's when Memo was in power, or Memon was in power, and people were trying to storm the banks to get their money out.
Are you talking
about
the Indie Media documentary or the documentary The Take?
Oh.
There's an iMedia documentary about Argentina that's really great as well, and the name is spacing me. If a listener wants to call in and tell us what film that was.
That'd be fantastic.
If anybody's listening that was in Pittsburgh that has a different perspective or wants to chime in on their personal perspective, please do. And if there's anybody that wasn't in Pittsburgh that disagrees with something that I've said or wants to clarify the stance of the apologies for the police or the apologies for the police state or the blaming of the protesters for anything, please call in with your bullshit ideas, because I'd love to hear you on my radio show so I could tell you live to go fuck yourself.
Okay, so I have someone in chat, and let's see if she's not online to call, if it's a she. Hillary 155 was at the G20. NWO employed guard dogs to deal with the population.
By the way, and the dogs were not muzzled. Not that it matters. I don't like to rely on law to save my ass. I don't like to rely on the Constitution. It's such a bullshit idea. When people – you're on the front line getting beaten by cops, and people say, this is against my constitutional rights. And it's like they don't care. That Constitution doesn't protect your ass from the fascist police state. The law doesn't protect your ass. But if for people that are concerned with the legal aspect, dogs in protest since 1992 they passed it that they had to have muzzles. They had to have a muzzle on. They couldn't be able to bite. No dogs that I saw had muzzles. And they were full on being used to threaten and intimidate people.
Wow. That's really amazing.
And the dogs also were not giving any kind of breathing protection when they started releasing toxic chemicals such as OC gas and the various pepper sprays. And they also were not giving hearing protection against the sonic sounds of the LRAD, which my head is still swimming from that powerful. I mean, I've seen the fucking Melvins live right up front.
Right.
And my head doesn't hurt as bad as it does after one of those LRADs.
Wow. That is absolutely phenomenal. It's just so crazy to me and to think that, that's how things are handled now. And particularly what I want to get back to is the fact that the safest place in the world to be was in the inner city neighborhoods. Because, you know, if anyone needs any sense of what ultimately matters, I mean, this whole notion of fighting for the workers and fighting for the people to have this freedom, let's always consider what exactly they're protecting. And it's protecting people who, organizations who've been classified as individuals with rights. One of our listeners who's in chat right now says that one of her concerns were about the masked people engaging in violence.
I was concerned about them too. Is she talking about the ones wearing the plastic masks and the full body armor with the lethal weapons? Or is she talking about the amount of people who are in the streets wearing no protective armor at all with no weapons who were pushing back against these masked thugs who were engaging in violence? I'm curious which one she's talking about. Because I did see a few broken windows, but I didn't see any injured pigs. I did see some overturned dumpsters, which are used to protect the life of the protesters, both the ones engaging the police and the ones there under nonviolent methods. And I use the term nonviolent loosely. The dumpster in the street method is not just to create chaos and to destroy neighborhoods. The dumpster tipped over in the street protects the protesters from being run down when the cops are driving their vehicles 75 miles an hour through neighborhoods with children playing in the yards to cart in more thugs with more gas and more weapons. The dumpsters act as a momentary deterrent that they have to jump off of their cars in their monkey suits and move the dumpster, and that gives the protesters the resistance time to mobilize and get to safety. So that's the purpose of the dumpsters. What your question is, person.
Well, it looks like first of all, Hillary 155 is a dude. My bad, and just corrected me in chat. And he was more concerned with the anarchist staging attacks.
Hillary, are you, I'm not meaning this to be in any way confrontational towards you, other than I'm going to ask you, are you supportive of a system that uses violent repression against its people when the people use their voice for dissent? Because if you're not in support of that, then you must at least respect those who are willing to attack that.
Well,
because those attacks are stemming from a point of necessity and the knowledge that we must fight back in any way we can. And keep in mind that these large-scale summits are by and large theater, and this is by and large symbolic. Obviously, most people attacking the line of police and attacking the windows of major corporations that in part fund and pay to bring these murderers to the city of Pittsburgh, because they profit so greatly off of the destruction of the planet that they need these pigs there to protect their business interests of destruction of the planet. The attacks on those corporations are strategic, and those attacks on those corporations are symbolic. That's something I want to say. That's not bringing down the system. But it is letting the system know that when you push us to a point, we will push back. And this is a small, small dose of what will happen if the people continue to be shut out of the decisions that affect their lives and if the system continues to destroy the planet. This is a small dose.
His specific comment was, I'll just read it to you here. I was worried about the situation where the police are told to stand there and take it when the masked anarchists throw rocks at them, and when the next day they release the pissed off cop, when the next day they're released, the pissed off cops go after the peaceful protesters.
Well, okay, there was one incident where the rocks were being thrown. I have a very close comrade who actually, the cops had grabbed a peaceful protester who was trying to evade arrest because he was a peaceful protester. He didn't use violence, tried to escape arrest, and was beaten into a fence and had his head pushed onto the concrete and hit repeatedly with batons because the cops could reach him. And at that point, an anarchist medic broke through the police line, risking life and limb and liberty to aid this ailing person who had been left sitting on the ground after the cops had their way with him. So the protesters, the cops had the medic and the other protesters surrounded and were ready to inflict more harm. Rocks started to be thrown at the cops to get the cops distracted away from the injured person and the medic and to pull them off of them, in a sense. It's a strategic tool used. And, you know, also, why do you fear for the safety of the cops? Do you see how much armor they have on? Do you see how protected they are? They're the ones firing, quote, less lethal weapons at the unarmored people in the streets.
But I do understand
the backlash. The backlash, yes. But do understand this, that those rocks being thrown at the cops, that's also a backlash. That's a backlash for the way we've been treated our entire lives. So I do understand the violence may escalate into more violence, but that doesn't – when somebody acts against the oppressor, you cannot blame the person who fought back for the actions of the state or the actions of the oppressor. If the oppressor becomes more violent, this is an abusive mentality of defending the abuser, because if you don't defend the abuser will become more abusive. And that's so we just have to put up with a certain amount of abuse to further abuse.
Hillary 155, put a comment and says, first of all, I don't think you're understanding me. Please continue your show. Hey, don't worry about it. It's not like I got a format anyway, so it's fine. It gives us something to do.
Call in, Hillary. Call in.
Yeah, please do. I'll just read you his comment. I was worried about the situation when the police should stand there, then they get pissed. I'm all for protesting, but I was concerned about people deliberately pissing off the cops, then leaving, and then the cops being let loose on the peaceful protesters. This was nothing, tiny dose, but it was a training session. They allowed the cops some training with dealing with the people and gave the people a taste of martial law to acclimate them to it. Again, I was
absolutely. Hillary is absolutely correct about that. This, again, I said this is theater. This is a way for them to show brute force and see what they can get away with. So if they know they can get away with small amounts of it, then they up it and they up it and they up it until eventually they will have full-time occupation of our streets and it'll be perfectly acceptable. But that's why we must fight back now. We fight back. If you don't fight back when they first start, it grows and it grows just like any other cancer. If you don't remove a cancer when it first starts to take root, that cancer grows and a small percentage of your body can be affected by cancer, and that cancer will destroy the functions of your entire body, eventually leading to the death of that body.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that another thing that, you know, anybody listening would pay to think about is that, you know, like Rabble was saying, when you get hit in the face, you hit someone back. And my position is not, I guess it's not traditionally nonviolent, because I don't take the Gandhi position, because again, I reject any kind of top-down suggestion of anything, and if you continue that, it's fucking irrelevant whatever your movement was, violent or not. And this is the most important part, and I've been thinking about this a lot, because, you know, I'll be completely honest, you know, I think one of the most intense videos that I saw was of the girl throwing her bicycle at the cop.
Oh, it was wonderful. That was wonderful.
And you know, like, there's so, you know, I know that there is in a lot of ways a knee-jerk response against in terms of criticizing that kind of action. Well, if you throw a bike at a cop, of course they're all going to beat you down and arrest you. That's accepting that. What we're seeing there is something that we have to expect if we are to perpetuate a system, hierarchical systems like the state, like the profit makers, like Robert, you know, all those things. And that what I saw in her face was what I feel every day when I, you know, she's just some girl on a bike and she's getting jabbed in the back with a club. You know, that agitates you. Okay, that's a natural animal response to being attacked. And
I want to note the amount of bravery that it takes to have the knowledge that you're facing a giant that is much more powerful, but still, she threw the bike. She didn't obey orders.
She fucking snarled and threw that bike. Okay, we're not talking about like, hey, I'm gonna throw my bike. She fucking snarled, and it was the expression on her face that was so powerful to me, because I know that, you know, every time, you know, whenever, you know, the surveillance video I saw, you know, 3 to 6 months ago, of the, you know, 6'4" police officer butt mushing a 15-year-old girl in her holding cell and beat the snot out of her for kicking her shoe at his feet and just being snotty or whatever. I'm just filled with I remember watching that and just going, you're fucking cops, fucking motherfuckers, you know, just spittle flying onto my computer screen. And, you know, like, people need to stop being dismayed by human beings reacting like that. People need to stop being surprised when there is any kind of...
Stop being accepting of the police act. People need to stop saying, well, of course the cops are going to act that way. So fucking what? So fucking what? Take them out. If that's the way you feel, if you've gotten to the point where you can accept brute force from pigs like that in the streets, and if you want to denounce me for using the term pigs as being as violent language, then you've got a problem with accepting violence, not me. I don't accept violence. I use it because if I have to. But you accept violence, and you claim nonviolence, and that's sick. That's a sick space to accept those actions of the cops as being somehow acceptable. And I'm not yelling at you, Travis, or G20. I'm not yelling at you. I'm saying
to those
who wish to denounce us for fighting back, you are sick. If you believe in nonviolence, then be there on the streets with us and use nonviolence as a tactic. But don't use nonviolence as a tactic to release yourself from the responsibility of fighting back. Because there were 10,000 people in that march. There were 14,000 people in the city who came to the city to say in whatever means they could or felt comfortable that they disagree with what the city was doing. They disagree with what the G20 is doing. They disagree with what the cops are doing. And not all of them fought back violently. And I have the highest amount of respect for every one of them that was there. Every fucking one of them.
You know, Rabble, years ago I was at a lumber protest. I think the guy's name is Charles Hurwitz, I think. He's one of the modern day, at least at the time, it's about 10 years ago, he's one of our modern day
robber barons.
And, you know, one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, and I almost did it, and I'm not going to lie, I was 19 years old and had never been at one of these things and never had police officers with their weapons drawn charging at me, and so I fucking ran. But, you know, I was there.
There's nothing wrong with running. There's nothing wrong with getting away. I'm serious. Like, there's nothing wrong with protecting yourself. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing – but if you don't go there first, if you're not there to make the initial claim, you know, to stake your ground and say you're wrong, and then if they threaten violence and you feel threatened, get the fuck out of there. Not a problem.
Totally. I mean, I'll never forget, though, one of the most powerful things I saw, and, you know, this has been burned into my brain ever since then, is that they were chanting a song called Don't Forget About the Back Door. And it was a way to sneak in onto the land because the cops were there protecting this land. It was, you know, it was like 40,000 acres of old growth, very small.
Protecting the land. They were not protecting the land.
Right. No,
the cops were protecting
the
instruments of destruction of the land.
Right.
They were protecting the trucks. They were protecting the workers.
Right.
They were, you know, they were not protecting the land.
Yeah, they were in no way, shape, or form protecting old-growth forests. No, they, in fact, were not doing that. They were protecting this corporate giant's interests. And people were sneaking in through this back trail, And I remember seeing this guy. He comes, it's fucking awesome, dude. He comes waltzing down the street, hands in his pockets, behind the police line. And waltzing with a smile on his face, with his hands in his pockets, and just smiling and sauntering, hands in his pockets, you know, his fucking corduroys, a bunch of goddamn hippies everywhere, right? And the cops fucking go up, and it was the most amazing thing to watch this guy immediately go, his face go flaccid and go fucking ragdoll. And just bleh, and fall to the ground. And it took like 5 or 6 cops. to round him up, pick him up, because he just became dead weight. And
right.
To watch that, keeping these 6 big guys busy, one dude who just came down the street, hands in his pocket, smiling, he was almost fucking whistling a song. And and by the way, when these folks go, when they do this kind of quote nonviolent resistance, these cops use some nasty holds to get you up and get you moving. You know what I mean? They're under your chin and all these pressure points, and this kid stayed fucking ragdoll, man. Well, these motherfuckers were in his pressure points, you know what I mean, fingers under his chin, yanking him up to his feet and dragging him away. It was a pretty amazing thing to see, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a great photograph of a gentleman who has been involved with resistance movements for over 50 years, sitting down in front of an LRAD with his hands up in the V-shaped peace signs, and he's in like this deep meditation and almost Buddhistic. He understands clear, and he's all alone, and he's blocking the ability of this truck to move towards the protesters, and he knows he's going to get beaten, and he knows he's going to jail. That man did as much effective work nonviolently as anybody else, as any kid who picked up a rock and threw it at the cop to get the cop away from beating up a medic, and vice versa. That they did the same work with different tactics, and that's what needs to be illustrated, is that there's not one group against another here. These groups have different tactics, and I think it's really, really important to notice the amount of repression of the state, of the voice of the people. If, in fact, the anarchists are some crazy idealist, pie-in-the-sky idea that is easily marginalized, why does it take the force of 4,000 armed goons in the streets to stop 100, 200, 300, 400 of them from getting their message out? It's not to protect the property. It's not to protect the banks. It's to stop that voice, to discredit that movement. It's obvious that their system is crumbling, and it's obvious that their power is so fragile. And if it weren't so fragile, that at a moment it could switch, the people could take it over and take it back, if they just chose to, they wouldn't use such massive amounts of control and repression. Anybody who uses that, just as in a conversation, the ideologue, the preacher who is screaming at you on the streets that you're going to hell, will continue to use repressive vocal manners to silence anybody who challenges him. And he won't allow conversation. He'll simply use some kind of an angry tone to repress that voice.
This plays into the whole, a lot of my memories of these type of number manipulation and all that kind of shit, my experience in the anti-war movement, and I remember, what was it? It was something like 200,000 people took to the streets in New York against the war. It didn't get on TV. 50,000, 60,000 in my city. I think that the media downplayed it to about maybe 10. Guys like Alex Jones saying there's 100 anarchists there and they're just being protected by cops. This is the type of stuff that is pervasive in the mass media, and this is why. As an anarchist, once you say, well, you know, I'm an anarchist, people immediately, I find this, 9 out of 10 times, people immediately have this expression on their face that is kind of mocking, that has kind of got this little shitty grin where they're like, oh,
right.
So you're one of those guys. Because what is happening, and this is a very, anarchists aren't about blowing shit up. Anarchists are people who are about living free and being happy, and
right. And I want to say I don't want to misrepresent myself either. I'm not a violent person. I'm not. And just because I'm vocally about supportive violent resistance, I don't use violent tactics. Anybody who knows me knows that I don't use violent tactics. I don't. But I will not ever be silent about my support of those that do. Because it's so important to just be vocally supportive and be in solidarity, just as I'm in solidarity with people using peaceful actions. I am completely in solidarity with that.
Yeah, and, you know, like, and, you know, one of Hillary's questions is, then choose a different word, look up anarchist in the dictionary. I'm all for violence. This dude's fucking hilarious, man. The thing is I don't like trying to come up with new vocabulary. And
Why should we allow the oppressors to take away our language as well? I mean.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the thing is that you know, words are in and of themselves. Yes, it's very philosophic. And words are empty. They're just vibrations coming out of our mouth that we all subjectively decide that mean shit. And with certain words carry a lot of weight, you know, a lot of the isms, socialism and capitalism and, you know, and anarchism. And the thing is that the word has become loaded with artificial sentiment that has been dispensed to the mass public, to the bottom, from the top. And choosing a different word I think it's completely irrelevant and completely useless, and I want to take anything I can back from them so they don't get my fucking words. God damn it.
Right. Say it loud, black block, and I'm proud.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
I tell you right now, the black block is our troops. We are the troops. The black block is the troops. Support your troops. Because do you see the amount of militaristic repression against the Tea Party or Tea Baggers? I like calling them Tea Baggers. It's funny. No, you don't. You see these Tea Parties, and it's a bunch of people upholding a system of repression. So they're not being used. The cops aren't being used to silence them. You see that when the anarchists gather. And not even just at the protests, but you see it for the months before, the preemptive raids upon every anarchist infrastructure. One of the first things they took out at the G20, before the G20 began, was taking out the infrastructure of food, free food that the anarchist community sets up to feed anybody and everybody who's hungry. It's run by Seeds of Peace, which is an amazing organization of decentralized organization of anarchists who gather and feed people for free at all these actions, the most delicious food that you'll have for free on the street anywhere. And so well done, so clean. Their setup is wonderful. They cook it all in a bus that looks the stainless steel kitchen in the bus is one of the nicest kitchens I've ever seen, and I've cooked in a lot of kitchens. And they take that out. The cops preemptively raid them and impound the bus. And then they take out the medic center. They raid the medic station. Why? Why would you raid a station that is completely dedicated to the care of the people? Because they're trying to break down the idea that we can defend and take care of ourselves. They're trying to remove that from our vocabulary. They're trying to remove the idea of self-preservation and of self-determination from us. The teabaggers, they don't want self-determination. They want the market. They want the law. They want the rule of law. They want the borders closed. They don't care about freedom. All they care about is comfort. And we don't care about comfort. We're saying we want to live free. And free means you have the ability to determine what you will do at any given moment. That is the definition of freedom, the ability to determine your life. And if we cannot be self-determined, which they obviously don't want us to feed ourselves or take care of ourselves, those are the two things they attack first, then what does that show you?
That they just want us to eat organic?
that's what Seeds of Peace is all organic. It's all like,
yeah,
locally grown,
exactly,
food.
Exactly. Well, Rabble, I was going to play a few clips. Are you going to stay with me or are you going to go relax? What's your plan, my man?
I'm going to stay with you. It's probably safer for me to be in constant contact with people after the threatening phone calls I received from Department of Homeland Security this weekend.
Exactly.
Hey, and you know what? It's funny. People. It may have been a prank call, but people were like, don't you think they would sound more official? And I'm like, well, what sounds more official than threatening violence and harm upon somebody's life? That sounds like a pretty official United States policy to me, number one. Number two, let's not forget these are a bunch of dumb fucking jocks who would be saying stupid shit on the phone. If people could understand the amount of disorganization the police had versus the amount of organization the anarchists had, I mean, the...
Oh, night and day.
The police communications were breached and became ineffective thanks to anarchist communications. I mean, they had to switch off of radio usage because they were infiltrated by anarchists who were decentralized, disorganized, and disseminating information that saved the lives of hundreds of people, potentially thousands.
Wow.
Fewest amount of arrests at any action so far this time. Just over 100 arrests. That's one eighth of the amount of people arrested at the RNC. That is one sixth of the amount of people arrested at the DNC. And that's thanks to the comrades who risked their life and liberty to let us know how to stay safe on the streets by breaching communication.
You know, and before we go into our clips, and then in the second hour we'll have you guys from the Motorhome Diaries on with us. Hopefully, if all goes well, my very first show hosting by myself goes off without a fucking hitch. What the fuck was I going to say? God damn it! I just totally forgot what I was going to say because I had to talk a bunch of shit first. That's bullshit.
any new words from Hillary in the chat? Hillary, please feel free to call in. I know I may sound threatening right now because I'm very riled up, but I will give anybody their chance to say their piece because I believe in that. I for one, believe in freedom of expression, no matter how that expression manifests itself.
Oh, and what I was going to say is that this whole movement, looking at how coordinated it was and how well put together it was in relation to the state organization, is a clear cut. If you ever were wondering what society would be like without a hierarchy, without the state, then what you have is you have this movement. You have people coming together, cooperating voluntarily, and really doing things better than the people who are living as thieves and living on the backs of the citizenry. So if you ever need a reference for, well, I don't think a stateless society could work, go ahead and look at this action this weekend, and go ahead and look at what people can do when they cooperate voluntarily.
A better example of looking at the action of anarchist voluntary cooperation would not be to look at the action in a crisis situation of attack and retreat. The better example would be to look at post-Katrina. The first people on the ground with medical aid to the people of New Orleans were local anarchists who formed Common Ground Collective. They were the first medical supplies on the ground. They were the first line of defense. And when I say defense, I mean armed defense against the people who were killing the supposed looters and rioters. I call them survivors because they were doing what they needed to do to survive.
Yeah.
So that's what I call them. But the first line of defense and the most effective was Common Ground Collective, which was a decentralized organization of anarchists who came together to rebuild homes, to provide food, to provide shelter, to provide medical aid. And they were also the one who received the most attacks. And this is a little known fact. There was a mutiny that took place amongst the National Guard. Many times trucks would show up and dump off medical supplies to Common Ground Collective by National Guardsmen who refused to follow orders and stole medical supplies that were not being used, were not being allowed to be taken out to be used for the people, and brought them to the people and used the anarchists to get those medical supplies into the people that needed them.
That's amazing.
There was a mutiny, and that's never hit major media. But this is fact. This happened. If you need to know that this happened, contact anybody who was there. Contact the residents. Don't even contact the anarchists. Contact the residents of New Orleans who saw the National Guard trucks in the dark of the night come down with their lights turned off, dumping off medical supplies, and doing it at risk of losing their positions in the military. It was a mutiny that took place, and that's
very
what
amazing.
Needs to happen now. That's what needs
crazy
to be
shit.
Happened.
That's awesome.
So that's a better example of when anarchists can work together, I think.
Yeah, that's fantastic. No, beautiful.
Both are relevant, and both are going to be relevant in the future.
Well, and if there's – and then I'll just say this, and then we'll go to our clips and come back with Motorhome Boys. But if we – one of the questions that gets asked is, what about the people who can't help themselves? What about you know, things like welfare, what about these? Well, there you fucking have it. You have people acting of their own accord to help those who are in a situation in which they need medicine, in which they need these things. And granted, it was, you know, it was this one group of people and all of that, but there you have it. You have physical examples of that people will do this shit.
Furthermore, people will do this, and they will be repressed by the state for taking such action.
Exactly. And on that note, I'm going to play a couple of clips, and we'll come back with the guys from the Motorhome Diaries. Ravel, I'm happy you're staying with us. I would miss you sorely in a gay way, so thank you for staying on the show. I'm going to go ahead and play you guys a couple of clips. The first one is by Murray Rothbard on the Federal Reserve. One of the things I saw a lot in the news was a lot of things about being anti-banks and anti-central banking and really alienating that institution as one of the foremost cancers of society. So I'm going to play you a little clip from Murray Rothbard on the Federal Reserve, and then after that we're going to bring one more clip of our good man George Carlin. He's my one of my heroes. So we'll be back in a few minutes, everybody.
Henry P. Davison, by late 1910, realizes they all should be brought together. I mean, let's get the whole thing worked out and have one plan, because otherwise we lose if you have several different proposals. So he gets the idea of a small group, a small top elite group, to get together at some pleasant resort and hammer out the draft of the plan. Okay, that's it. Write the bill, which would then become the Fed. And they met at Jekyll Island Club in Georgia. It was top secret, okay, because they realized that the public doesn't like, first of all, the public didn't trust banks for good reason. Second of all, they didn't trust Wall Street. And third of all, they certainly don't like secret conclaves to put in a central bank. So it's the sort of thing we're now familiar with, sort of like a CIA thing. Oldrich chartered a private car from New York, a private railroad car to go down to Jekyll Island. And he told everybody, this is a duck hunting expedition. In those days, Jekyll Island Club was largely a duck hunting club. I don't know where they hunt ducks anymore. I know about 1910, I don't know about now. But anyway, he said, no, we're just going on a friendly duck hunting expedition. This was in November, I guess, which is duck season. They all went out under an assumed name, by the way. You know, Joe Jones, whatever their names were, except for not Henry P. Davison. And one of the press apparently got wind of this. One enterprising reporter found out what they were doing, and he was silenced by Davison. Somehow Davison was able to give him an offer he couldn't refuse. Well, another interesting thing is who got them the... You have to be a member of a club to arrange the facilities. And neither of these guys, as big shoddy as they were, none of these guys were members of the Jekyll Island Club. J.P. Morgan, however, was a member. And so the conjecture is, which I think is fairly substantiated, that J.P. Morgan facilitated, was the guy who turned over the facilities from the Jekyll Island Club to this top-secret week-long conclave. So he had the secret six, so to speak, the six guys who got together and hammered out the Fed. Who were they? Well, of course, the chairman of the one who called the meeting officially was Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, Rockefeller-in-law. Henry P. Davison, of course, Morgan partner, who had the idea of this. Paul Warburg, Kuhn-Loeb partner. Frank Vanderlip, who was vice president of the National City Bank, who was a big Rockefeller, which is a big Rockefeller bank. Also a big activist type in the forefront. And Charles Norton, who was the president of the First National Bank of New York, which is one of the top Morgan banks. So you have five people, five big businessmen at this meeting, two Rockefeller persons, Aldrich and Vanderlip, two Morgan persons, Davison and Norton, and one Kuhn-Loeb person, Warburg. It's like a 2-2-1 parody. It's like the Washington Naval Agreement, 1920s. And a sixth guy to actually do the draftsmanship, a technician. You need a technician, an economist, in other words. A Harvard professor, naturally. If you know anything about history and statist history, Harvard's usually in there first. A. Pyatt Andrew, who had been assistant to Aldrich in the National Monetary Commission, he was there to actually get with the resources, the research of the National Monetary Commission, actually be able to provide the techniques of it. So this is also this meeting symbolizes many things. It symbolizes the Rockefeller-Morgan-Kuhn-Loeb alliance and the proportionate weight of them, and the alliance of the big business types with economists and technicians actually do the work, you know, the actual detailed stuff. So basically, what they hammered out an agreement, and basically it was basically the Warburg plan with a little soupçon of stuff from Morowitz. The only real argument they ever had, either now or later, was that Aldrich wanted a Frank Central Bank thing, one bank where the banker's really running it, the banker's making all the appointments. He wanted a Frank open Central Bank. And Warburg said, no, I'd love to have a central bank. We couldn't get away with it in the United States. We should have fake decentralization, make 12 regions and claim it's not really a central bank, and give a political sop to the public. And essentially he won out on that. The funny thing is, here you have a politician, Aldrich, and wanted a straight, hard down-the-line ideological program, and Warburg, the banker, thinking in terms of politics. It's kind of an interesting switch. At any rate, that was the plan they hammered out. Vanderlip wrote the actual final draft. And they emerged from Jekyll Island with the plan. Now, despite all the various changes, et cetera, that's essentially what was adopted in the Federal Reserve Act in December 1913.
I'd like to do something called baseball and football, because these two things are such a part of our lives, these two activities, and yet they're so different. Baseball is pastoral, 19th century. Football is technological, 20th century. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, War Memorial Stadium. In baseball, you wear a cap. In football, you wear a helmet. Baseball has a seventh-inning stretch. Football has a two-minute warning. Baseball has no time limit. We don't know how long it's going to last. We might have extra innings. Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death. Football is based on downs. What down is it? Baseball is based on ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. In football, you get a penalty. In baseball, you make an error. Whoops. In baseball, in the stands, there's something of a picnic feeling. You know, emotions may run high, but there's not that much unpleasantness. In football, in the stands, you can be sure that at least 27 times during the game, you were capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. And to sum this up, the objects of the game is quite different. The object of the game in football is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home. I'm going home! I'm going home!
All right, that was my man, George Carlin. I picked that clip all by myself, by the way, Rabble.
That's good. That's good.
My fucking guests aren't on hold, so hopefully they'll call in tonight. Wouldn't that suck? So first I try to get Stefan Molyneux, and he's a prick. And then I try and get the Motorhome Diaries, and, you know, they're not on yet, but I'm not going to call them pricks yet.
I'll be right back briefly. Hold on. Keep talking.
They might be running late. So I want to continue on then with our some of the things we've been talking about, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about we got someone in. Are they calling in yet? No. Some of the differences. One of the things that I find systemically wrong in market anarchy, and again, this is, you know, this is a school of thought that I'm vocal about subscribing to. And what I'm exactly subscribing to is a volunteer society, volunteer cooperation as the central core of our social structure, as opposed to the initiation of force via the state as the central core of our social structure. And one of the issues that I find in being this kind of fucking weird anti-civilization market guy, wacko, is that I find a lot of apologists out there, especially in reading other market anarchist thought and ideas, a lot of apologists out there for things like Walmart, for some of these companies. And, you know, one of the main issues is that, you know, a lot of the market anarchists have virtually no presence, or literally no presence at these events of solidarity at G20 and these other things. And as a dissenter amongst the group, I say, fuck you, you fucking pricks. Stop supporting these companies. You know, here's what I think, you know, and Rabble and I have talked a lot about this, is that they, and I think that this psychological perspective kind of permeates a lot of different movements, is that, you know, particularly in market anarchy, you're dealing with a lot of white people who wish they didn't have to pay taxes and wish they were rich. And they envision a system wherein they can be just that. And it is a fucking cancer with any kind of movement or any kind of ideas that ask for freedom. And so I'm here right now to say what I believe and what I predict is that if any of these people really considers what a free system would do, is that a free system, okay, whether you want to say free, whatever, I'm just talking about a free system would mean the fucking end of all of these things, which means you're not going to get fucking rich because there's no fucking huge, ridiculous paper money for you to amass huge mountains of. There's no fucking commodity for you to amass mountains of. What you need for that is a top-down hierarchical system. And if you support that, if that's ultimately what you want, if you just want this organization to go away so that you yourself can amass huge mountains of wealth and buy yourself a bunch of ridiculous shit that you don't need, then fuck you. Fuck you and go fucking vote, you asshole. Seriously, I'm so fucking sick of these guys who just want their cake and eat it too, who walk out of this system thinking that one day they'll be rich and they'll be powerful. Fuck you. I got news for you, you fucking prick. This system that you support, this thing that you're so into, would mean the end of civilization as you know it, which means you're not going to be some fucking king. You're not going to be some rich asshole. You're going to be someone, like the rest of us, who has to get the things that they need to survive and just try and be happy. And that's what you'll have to do. You're going to have to cooperate with your neighbor. You're going to have to cooperate with the people around you to fucking survive. And if you're going to support these banks in any way, you're going to support any of these kind of institutions as a product of some system that you're advocating, then fuck you. So
right. I want to, on that note, I want to mention something. When talking to, let's say, a police officer about why they would do what they did, why the pig would be there, the answer is going to be, well, I need to have a job so I can feed myself. And I just want to say the amazing thing that you're missing out on, Pig, is that your side is feeding yourselves. On our side, we feed each other. And that's what you're missing. That's what you're missing, is that we take care of each other. It's not about taking care of yourself. It's not about the lone, rugged individual. And there was at one of the Tea Party gatherings, the teabaggers, there was a black man with a gun in public, an assault rifle, and he was not taken out by the police. And he was interviewed, and he said that the names that he gave in his interview were Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. He was naming the white slave owners as being his they gave him the freedom to carry that gun. Now, if that black man had mentioned Fred Hampton or Huey Newton or Mumia Abu-Jamal or Africa Move, if he had mentioned any of those groups, if he had mentioned any great black, if he had mentioned Nat Turner gave him the right to carry that gun, I guarantee you that man would not have been on TV and that man would have been disappeared. And that's what people need to understand, is that if you represent the voice of true freedom and dissent, then you are disappeared. If you uphold the system, no matter what you do, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay as long as that system can repress those who are fighting for real freedom. But if that system can cease to repress the movement of dissent, then you better believe. You better believe that you're not safe anymore, because that system won't be there to protect you, because you won't be upholding that system. Does this make any sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And, you know, I've said this before. Maybe I'm just been reading too much Derek Jensen and too much Daniel Quinn, but for 90% of this species' existence on this planet, for 90% of it, okay, for Homo sapiens sapiens' existence, you survived by feeding each other. Now, I tend to look at things economically. I tend to look at things in terms of incentives and disincentives. And call that what you want. It's my efforts to not bring my emotion too much into it. I know that's impossible ultimately, but that's just my methodology for trying to look at systems that work versus systems that don't, systems that are sustainable versus systems that are not. And one of the things that have to be clear, and a lot of market anarchists are just dicks. You know, again, they're just dicks. They're Stefan Molyneux. You know, like they just want shit for themselves. And the fact of the matter is that in a free society, you are free to leave if you want. You are free to go on your own, but at your own fucking peril, okay? The incentives to cooperate with your neighbor, to talk with your neighbor, to interact with your neighbor, all these things that are systemically a part of the human animal, and not just the human animal, but many other social animals that move in groups and operate in groups, is that your survival depends on cooperating with your neighbor, on feeding each other. Now, I know that in that context, it becomes unconscious because it's just a necessary part of how one lives. But that's the way it works. And so it's not about some sense of, you know, because I hate cheap morality. Let's feed the babies. Yeah, let's feed the fucking babies. But don't be such a fucking jerk about it, you know. Don't burn some incense or some shit, you know what I mean? The fact of the matter is that in order for us to survive long-term as a species, we've got to do things how we used to do it. 90% of our existence on this planet, civilization is not something to be upheld at all costs. This is not something that we have to try and find it. You know, just maybe we can make it a stateless civilization. It doesn't fucking exist. That is a D&D shit. That is some fucking Dungeons and Dragons. That's not even good Dungeons and Dragons shit. That's fucking stupid. All right? It is an utter and complete contradiction. And that if you're really going to advocate a stateless society, whatever your position is within that spectrum of thought, understand this and understand it very clearly, that shit will be dramatically fucking different without the state. You will not have all your fucking SUVs and your Nintendos and your computers, because there's no need for that shit in a society that is sustainable. There's no fucking incentive to make that shit in a society that is actually, in a human society that is actually sustainable. And so understand very clearly, market anarchists, that if you're going to really advocate a stateless society, if you're really pushing for that and you really mean it, then what you better be thinking about is becoming more cooperative with your neighbors. It's becoming a old school tribal style, 21st century tribalism. That's what you have to look forward to. If that scares you, then you ain't a fucking anarchist, dick. God, I got a lot of rage tonight. I think it's because I'm attacking my own. It's a daddy issue. Fucking daddy issue. So Hillary155 has a good question. I wish you would call in, man, but define civilization. Rabble, you have a good definition for that. You want to take that one?
I was going to type it into the chat room, and it's taking a lot of effort to get my letters correct there. So, I'll take it. This one live. Civilization can be, for conversation purposes, the conversation we're having, civilization could be defined as the concentration of people in a way that that requires the import and export of resources, number one. Number two, civilization is anything that builds false infrastructure. And when I say false, I don't mean that it's not there. I mean that it is a form of infrastructure that is unnatural, such as concrete and steel, reinforced cities and roads, concentrated in small areas, to separate one from the land base. For the purpose of quote-unquote survival. But that survival is only necessary because you've effectively destroyed the ecosystem and you must protect yourself from nature. You're protecting yourself from nature as opposed to integrating and being a part of nature. But mostly civilization can be defined as a concentration of people and a concentration of resources. And the resources rarely represent the people there. They are... The threat of scarcity has been used as the tactic to create civilization, to create cities, to get people to move into smaller areas, confined areas, and then taxation becomes apparent because a state structure will pop up for the defense of the resources of those people, which, by the way, when I say defense of the resources of those people, I actually mean the defense of the thieves who are stealing the resources from another community to bring into that community, because there is no way that we would have any of the resources we have in St. Louis City if we were left to fend for ourselves. But we must steal resources from surrounding communities, and those communities may be as far as the other side of the world, but we have to steal those resources from them and then defend the thieves who stole them, all to maintain a sense of comfort or security.
And one of the things that – great answer, by the way. Do you fucking prepare this shit? Do you have – because you got some good answers. You
no,
think about
no.
it a little bit.
No, I do have a, I do have a secret league of I have my, my advisors that and my teleprompter.
So,
and, you know, just because I happen to choose the same advisors that the guy before me chose, pay no mind. Don't you worry your pretty little head about that. I'm different.
No, you are. You are.
I represent
you're different
change.
And you're special. So again,
I'm a snowflake.
All callers are welcome at 646-200-3974. I'm sorry I didn't put out the number before now, but if you're at the website and you're listening to this, and the fucking number's there, and it's been there the whole time. So,
And you are full of anger. I'm the one that's been getting beaten up by cops the last week, and you're the one that's pissed. This is great. I love it.
I think it's because I love the sound of my own voice. I'm a complete and utter nihilist. I love me a lot.
Right.
And... And I'm just trying to, eat up time. You know, Daniel Quinn talks about, keeping food under lock and key. And I think that totally plays into maybe, like, the most central of the hierarchy's goals is the bringing in of resources and, like you were just describing, protecting them and keeping the food under lock and key. And Rambo and I have discussed, other societies that were quite large that sprung up in quote-unquote prehistory, and the major difference between them and hierarchies as we know them was that they collected food and they did store it, but they did not keep it under lock and key. The food stores were open, and you took what you needed, and you went on your way, and you didn't have to pay for it necessarily. You know, when we start picking apart the system and start looking at its major problems and isolating them, especially when we're in this format where we're exchanging ideas and we're thinking about things, we have to really start looking at these little details that we've taken for granted for a long time. Last week we had farmer Joel Salathan on. He was fucking awesome. And he described going to, at one point, needing to go to a food bank. Excuse me. At the food bank, they said, hey, we know you're a farmer, and we have 4,000 pounds. Was it like 4,000 pounds of sweet potatoes, Rabble?
Yeah, something like that.
They had like 4,000 pounds of sweet potatoes, and they said, can you take them? And he said, well, yeah, we can feed them to the pigs, and we can fucking eat them ourselves too. But one of the things he was really blown away by is he said, how is it that you guys are a fucking food bank and you have 4,000 pounds of sweet potatoes sitting here? And the response was that, the people who come here, they don't want that. You know, they want the boxed foods, they want the ho-hos, they want all that kind of stuff. And it's because it's so built into our culture that the food is kept under lock and key that we, like, double impose that on ourselves. And rather than eat a beautiful sweet potato, which is packed with all these nutrients, pretty easy to prepare and all these things, we would rather buy this boxed-up MSG chemical-laden thing that we think is just better all around because, fuck, I don't want to cook a sweet potato, and I can just crack this thing open and boil it in some water and I'm good to go. It takes like 5 minutes, and then I can watch Alf. And I fucking miss Alf, by the way.
Right.
Remember
can
Alf?
Can I jump in about food really quick?
Yes, please.
Now, because this is, before I lose this thought, which happens quite often, I lose thoughts. food. When we're not able to get food from the anarchist community, at one point we were running all around trying to hop buses and get out of any presence of militarized police just because they were so repressive that we were heading back towards the place we were staying. And I this is going to be a comment on race situations in this country and resistance and food and community and how those things all tie in. What you hear so often within the resistance communities that are largely white is the lack of you hear this as a critique that it's just a bunch of white boys that why aren't there people of color there? Well, there are people of color. Number one, there are many people of color in the resistance movement, but in this country, simply being black and being alive is resistance, period. And I'm gonna say that again: simply being of color, being black or Latino, in this country and being alive and being out of jail is resistance. And that was the community that was so supportive of seeing us in the streets. And they understand the overwhelming power of the police state to crush you, because that's what they experience a lot in their life on a daily basis. They experience the overwhelming repression of the police state. And we were hungry. We were very hungry. And there was we were walking by, and all the businesses were closed down, except for one business, which was a black-owned bar. And most of, I would say all of the people inside were black. And we asked the guy at the door, "Hey, man, is there a place around here to get some food?" And he looked at us, and he said, "Are y'all the protesters?" And we said, "Yeah." And he said, "Tell you what, there's free food in the kitchen. Go ahead." And they brought us in, and they served us up chicken and rice and beans and collard greens and bread, and even gave us free drinks if we wanted them at the bar. That's support. That's support of a community that has long been downtrodden and felt the repressive arm of the state, understanding how to feed each other, how to take care of each other, and how to look out for each other. Despite all differences on the surface, despite all political claims, despite all rhetoric, despite all activity, they had our backs. They had our backs. You know, so don't pretend, white liberal America, that you are somehow aligning yourself with the resistance of the black community because you voted for Obama. Don't pretend that you're crushing racism because you put an Obama sticker on your car. You're still a part of the white male hierarchy system of this country, and you still accept your white privilege and thrive upon it. It is the people of resistance all over this country that know how to take care of each other, period.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because, you know, we're talking about a community that is a direct result of the state and of state capitalism and of all is a direct result of those things, and it's amazing to me that these swaths, I mean, these are big demographics. This is no small little group of people. These are massive, sprawling demographics. And the fact that and again this goes back to my rant from earlier, my swear word laden rant, is that if you're going in with any idea and you're not thinking of those groups, if they're not occurring to you, then, you know, and it's typically white liberals who kind of candy coat it, and they're like, "Oh, well, you know, there's these, some great college programs that have been started," and there's no doubt that people have received benefit from programs. I won't question that. That's stupid to do. However, those systems are not designed to help every individual and all their needs. They're not designed for that. They're designed to produce some statistics and garner lots of money. Tax money, specifically, taxes being theft from the citizenry by the state to fund more of its programs. So ultimately, the people who truly benefit from any of these education programs or any of these relocate, the people who benefit directly and the most are always going to be those on top, which is going to be the big businesses who get involved. For example, public schools having Pepsi. You know, I remember one story. I worked at a bakery, and I had this woman come in, and she was going to order a bunch of food she worked for the school district. She was going to order a whole bunch of sandwiches and pastries and such for this faculty meeting that they were going to have. And she said, "Do you guys have any soda?" And I said, "Yes, we do. We have Pepsi and also Diet Pepsi." And I'll never forget this. She said, "Oh, I can't buy Pepsi because Coke is our school's soda pop provider." So it was actually built into her budget by law that she could not purchase Pepsi because Coca-Cola was the soda that was built into the fucking school's budget. And, you know, this is what I'm talking about, is that this is despite these programs, all of that shit still flows through it and is specifically meant to benefit those at the top by extra funding or by corporate grants or subsidies. you know, a way for Coca-Cola to make millions of more dollars off of caffeinating and putting sugar into little kids' bodies. Specifically, you know, what is it, fucking Pizza Hut has hubs in high schools. You know, all these companies have a place in these schools. All these companies have been built into the system, and we fucking subsidize them. So, you know, these programs that are meant to benefit all these people, and clearly the huge swaths, the huge demographics of all these people still exist. And there's a reason why they reacted the way they did to the protesters, because those people represent a change in direction. You know, this movement represents a change in vision. It represents a dramatic departure from all the shit that we have that we're buried in now. And to those at the very, very bottom, that sounds really great. And they naturally gave of their food. They didn't keep their food under lock and key. They opened up the food stores and fed people. And in some cases, offered to get them drunk. I mean, God bless them. And, you know, that's yet another example of anarchism, like a living, breathing anarchism, not just, you know, ideologies, not just shit that some fucking philosopher wrote down in a book, but a living, breathing freedom, living, breathing cooperation, living, breathing care of one's neighbors. And not in some fucking hoity-toity bullshit kind of way. As a direct response saying that you guys represent you guys represent a survival of the species, a survival of freedom. You represent all those things. And that is a mutually beneficial thing for everybody, except those on top. With the exception of the five people running everything, it's a mutually beneficial situation for the other 95% of us fucking pyramid builders. If you will. I was reading Daniel Quinn today, yes. So we're still taking callers, everybody. No callers on hold. Nobody likes us. Hurting my self-esteem.
Yeah, I really wish Hillary or NWO or anybody would call in with their perspectives, because the chat room is the best chat room I've seen tonight so far. And
no, it is really good.
Complimented, but...
NWO411 has an interesting statement. Nothing in our society is uncorruptible. Thanks, money. And I, you know, that's something that I did want to talk about tonight is in the event that we didn't have a guest, which we don't. By the way, am I a failure for my guest not showing up?
No.
I mean, are you not judging me quietly?
No, not at all. I'm just thinking, okay. I'm wondering if they're, what happened to them, if they're okay or...
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, they get fucked with a lot by cops. They
if
get
you
fucked
want,
with
you can message me their number, and I can call them in case they forgot or something, in case their time zones were different.
Yeah, no, totally.
I can hang up and call them. You can keep the show going.
You know what? Fuck it. We've got 30 minutes left. We're doing good. I'll just email them. We'll try and get them on another date. It's totally fine, man. We're doing great. You're doing great. You're great. I wanted to talk a little bit about money and the idea of money and what it actually is, because I tend to depart in this way, because I don't think that we've come to in our hierarchical society come to compartmentalize a lot of things that are givens in the more traditional sustainable human communities of the first 90,000 years of humanity. And one of those things is compartmentalizing the idea of any kind of good that you could trade. Now, Rabble had a great story that he told me the other day, and I'm going to go ahead and retell it and probably paraphrase it terribly, but I think it's a really great story. Rabble grows veggies, had a neighbor move in, took food to his neighbor. A neighbor he'd never met before, ended up being apparently like a military guy, maybe a military family or something, so very different from him, but brought him these beautiful vegetables. And they engaged in an exchange. He gave them food. They received food. There was no money passed. There was no funny money or some weird metal. There was none of that. But it was an exchange. There was a trade that happened there. And I don't think that a commodity of trade need be a physical something with some kind of subjective value. It can be. I'm just saying it doesn't need to be. And when we talk about money, one of the first things I think of is that the type of societal structure that we have now is dependent not on commodities of trade, not on commodities or things that we might exchange of mutual beneficialness or of subjective value that we think. Money specifically as we know it is an enforced form of trade wherein very few benefit from it. There's a scramble, and this goes for paper money. The gold rush is a perfect example. Anytime, and this is one of my big problems with small government libertarian types, is that as long as you have an organization like the state in whatever kind of form that it is, it's going to tax and it's going to use some form of currency. It's either going to directly control it or it's going to use some other kind. Now, typically, governments use gold and they use silver. Because they use gold and silver, there are these huge, nasty, violent rushes to attain shitloads of it. It produces the robber barons. It produces greedy fucks who kill each other to fucking blast holes in these mountains and destroy the planet. And it's when we have some kind of assigned, enforced form of trade that you end up with capitalism as we know it. It's dependent on that type of quote-unquote monetary system. If you take that away, I mean the state, then what you have are people trading things that you might not think they're trading for. And this brings me back to Rabble's story of bringing food to his neighbor. That there was an exchange there. Two parties received something of benefit, one more concrete, the other one more abstract. The neighbors received beautiful food from someone they'd never met before who'd grown this sweat off their backs and brought it to them. The giver, in this case my dear co-host, received a deeper connection with his fellow human, a deeper sense of community. And that is, in my opinion, something that is profitable in the positive, profitable for the overall human race because it represents an exchange that didn't have some shitty kind of form of value on it that was just a class exchange. It was none of those things. But it was an exchange, and both parties received something. So having a form of trade, that doesn't necessarily mean banks and paper money and ridiculous shit like that. Civilization is dependent on those things, but trade amongst normal people is not.
You know what I want to say something if you don't – are you okay with
that? Yeah, no, I'm done. I was starting to run out of shit to say, and I was just starting to improvise, so thank you.
Yeah, I was catching your pausing between the ands and what you were saying, picking up on your flow there. I want to say that personally I feel that the inspection of trade in that sense demeans the actual action. It's almost like, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but I am saying that this is what happens inherently, is that it's keeping tabs. And the thing that I know about my community, and when I see somebody from the outside of my community that starts interacting with us, and the difference is, we don't at all keep tabs on what's fair as far as, you know, who's got money to pay for what and
right.
How we're going to even this. Nobody keeps tabs except for those who still are attached to money. The rest of us just, if there's money in our pocket and the money is needed, it's there. It's gone. There's no question. There's absolutely no keeping tabs, and there's no, like, remembering of, like, well, I put in this much more than you did, or I put in
right.
less, so I owe this time. You never hear, like, well, you got breakfast yesterday, so I'll get it today. You'll never hear
right.
that, really. It'll just naturally happen that people will start doing this. And so that I don't like inspecting the idea of trade. And I think that money is not the root of all evil. Money is the tool used because of profit, the idea of profit.
Right.
That is the root of evil. The idea that one can create value beyond and above the inherent value of something. That one can turn a self-sustaining food item into the ability to become two self-sustaining food items without growing anything. That I can turn a bag of carrots into an amount of profit to purchase two bags of carrots next time, to sell them and get four bags next time and sell them and get eight, is sick. It's a sickness because that's not how trade in the survival or in the communal voluntary sense can work. It does not work that way. If we begin to think on those terms, then we begin to view not only the commodities, the things in our life as commodities, such as food, water, shelter, the necessities become immediately commodified, immediately. Those things are the first things to get commodified because they're necessities. But the joys of life, the pleasures of life also are commodities. And when you make a commodity of something that brings pleasure, make a commodity of sex, make a commodity of music, make a commodity of art, make a commodity of poetry, a commodity of exchange of ideas, you've already given up the ability to inherently enjoy life, and you have to keep tabs.
And no, I, you know, and I,
the simple idea of focusing on trade or the simple idea of money alone is inherently ridiculously evil. Period.
You know, I don't
believe in no market. I believe in no money. I know that sounds a little too radical for a lot of people out there.
Sorry,
but I'll tell you what.
Say that again, man. What, you don't believe in what? And what?
I don't believe in no market. I believe in no money. Period. And I'm not talking about a barter economy. I don't want a fucking barter economy. I don't want an economy. I don't want to keep tabs on my life. I don't want others to keep tabs on what they feel they owe me or what they feel I owe them. I want there just to be a simple enjoyment of not only the necessities, but of the extremities of life. I want people to be able to not have to worry about enjoying something because they can't afford it or because they'd be in debt for it. That's thievery of the highest degree, to take away the ability to enjoy one another. And I'll tell you what, talk about religion, the simple idea that God is a hierarchy is the first level of separation from ourselves. So when you if you want to believe in God, that's fine. But if you want to believe that God is something that's above you and not within you, then you're fucked, because you've just separated yourself from the enjoyment of humanity, period.
You know, and I actually agree with you. And I could even point at myself as a clear case study of compartmentalizing something that should be quite natural. When I focus in on a trade taking place, my intent is to show that that kind of action between two people or four people or 10 people or communities with each other need not be it's one of those things where it should be just a given that not profit making, that's not a given. That's something we had to create. The givens were interacting and interaction with communities and being able to help one another. And I'm a victim again of the system myself, because I end up compartmentalizing those exchanges. My intent is to show that those exchanges are not dependent on profit. In fact, the best kind are ones where it's not really even in using the word exchange implies some kind reward policy. And really, it shouldn't be any of those things. It should just be a given, with the ultimate intent of just being able to have what you need and being happy. And
That's the other the most important thing that you said is and being happy. And people see us in the streets in America fighting against the evil empire. And I hate to say evil empire because it's redundant and I don't like repeating myself. But they see us fighting in the streets and they say, well, why are they what are you protesting? You've got food, you've got water, you've got it better than anybody else. And somebody that would say, well, I'm protesting because they don't have enough. Yes, that's absolutely valid, and that's a great reason why I'm out there. But the greater reason why I'm out there is, yeah, I've got food, I've got water, I've got shelter. I want love. And I'm not being cliche. I want love. I want to give love. And I'm not free to do that. I am not free to share my talents and my joys with anybody whom I want to, and I'm not free to accept those talents and joys from others. It's a struggle. We should not have to struggle to share in the joys of living. And so it's not just a fight for survival, for the base of survival. It's a fight to enjoy life. And anybody that forgets that, forget even fighting. Because if you're fighting for bread, then, you know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that's the highest amount of self-respect you have, is that you have to fight just to live, just to survive, because I don't. I have to fight to survive, and I have to fight to create, because I'm a creative person, and we're all creative people. And creativity being boxed in and taken away, that's murder beyond murder. That's the slowest genocide that you could see happen over the last 1,000 years. The slowest genocide has not been the decimation of the indigenous peoples. It's been the decimation of their culture, the decimation of their ability to create language, their ability to create art freely. That's what makes them dangerous. That's why they had to be crushed, because they wouldn't sell their art. They would give it away. They wouldn't buy your art. They would want to enjoy it without paying for it. You know, that's the genocide. That's the TV. That's the media. That's the clothing. That's the fucking shopping malls. That's the cars. That's the image. That's the hairdos. That's the beards. That's the fucking the music. That's the specialized music stores. All of that is the slow genocide of our creativity.
Absolutely. And the erosion of our creativity, the erosion of our spirits, and really what is cool about being human is the ultimate form of control. There's a reason why public schools are working art and music out of their programs, because that's just dangerous, man. You don't think much about the system when you're just stuck doing shitty math. But when you can start drawing pictures and you can start imagining, your brain grows stronger. Your soul grows stronger. You as a person grow stronger, a little more in touch with something. Call it divine, call it the human experience, call it both. I don't give a shit.
Who are the ones that fight harder, the ones with a strong soul or the ones with the PhDs?
Well, right. I mean, the ones with the PhD just run for office or
right.
or become shareholders. You know, it's when we think in terms of amassing more than we need, living beyond our means, what we have done is we have stepped out of the the previously sustainable human community. We have stepped outside of that and are engaging in an experiment that we're the only ones who have hung on to it. World culture for the past 10,000 years is the first time in 100,000 years that you've got a group who are hanging on to this shit for dear life. And this is constantly reinforced. I mean, you know, the fucking show about the Cribs, you know, on the MTV, this is reinforced. Okay, they play that shit because they want you to want that shit. And even though you're never going to fucking get it, all right, you're never going to fucking get it, they want you to want it. Because if you desire that, then you will buy into the system completely. Then you will work the 10 hours a day to try and accumulate what those motherfuckers have. And in a societal system of living well beyond your means, of amassing a whole bunch of shit you don't need, it doesn't usually end in happiness. It does. I would like to think that in a lot of ways, I'm a much happier guy than a lot of these gajillionaires, ultimately, at the end of the day. I would like to think that. I hope it's fucking true. Otherwise, I've been delusional my entire life, and I'm going to get really fucking depressed, and I'll have to make money to attain happiness. And I don't want that for me, because I don't want to work that much. I got video games and shit to play. I'm busy, all right, with other shit. But, you know, Raul, I think you're absolutely right, man. I mean, like, when our basis becomes what we can get out of the other person we're interacting with, when we, again, compartmentalize, you know, something that, you know, an interaction, yes, we are dependent on one another, and yes, different people have different skills. I buy all that. But when we become to assign value to people and assign value to what they can do, then we want to profit off of them.
Right, and I think it's important now at this point to define sustainability, because we keep using that word.
That's true, we do. I would say that real sustainability is something that for the long term is, you know, specifically about human communities. A sustainable human community is one that for the long term does not swallow up all the resources, that does not destroy the planet, does not destroy each other in terms of communities, is one that for the long term encourages both a healthier, you know, kind of population balance on the planet. It is something that nurtures cooperation, and it's something that nurtures the natural health of the planet. Non-sustainability would be something akin to our system, where we puncture holes in mountains, we decimate species, we decimate each other, and we spawn like mice with too much food. A sustainable system is something that can go for a very, very, very long time and on into eternity, and can progress and can do all those things, but doesn't act like a cancer. And so all these go green and all these you know, get the energy efficient light bulb, and you'll. But what is it? An energy efficient light bulb. You can watch TV for 3 hours more.
Those things
are all bells and whistles to keep us buying into the civilization as we know it, protected at all costs. Those are not sustainable things. They use that language to fuck with us.
I think metaphors are important in our society because we have become a spectacle and we cannot see things as they are. We must see things through the eyes of some sort of an imitation of the truth. And that's what a metaphor does so well, is it gives you an imitation of the truth and allows you then to see through the mask, Shakespearean, if you will. Metaphor, sustain. Sustain musically is the elongated ringing of a note and how long that note will last upon the single strike of a guitar string. And when you pluck that string once, the length that that note lasts is called sustain. And what you want there for sustainability is minimal impact, minimal amount of striking, maximum amount of use. And what that leads to is, number one, your string, if you just simply hit your string every time it starts to die off, your string's going to last a lot longer. In fact, it might not ever break. And the amount of energy that you expound into creating that sound is greatly decreased and therefore can be stretched out over a longer time. So if we think about sustainability and sustain in the sense of music and the lowest amount of impact for the greatest amount of reward, that's one aspect of sustainability. The other aspect of sustainability is to always feed into as much as or more than you take out. And in an ecosystem, in the whole circle of life, Lion King, Disney World way, those animals are sustainable because they do feed into each other. They feed into the earth. They feed into the water, the air. It all feeds into each other and creates a perfectly sustainable ecosystem, biodome with Pauly Shore, if you will. That movie definitely could be seen as sustainable because it really seemed like it went on for forever.
Hell yeah. I love that fucking movie. Stephen Baldwin like a motherfucker.
But I think that when we're talking about sustainable sustainable culture, sustainable communities, we have to remember that as our comrade Mike Cannon always says, we need more mutual aid and less mutual aid. We need to always remember to put back in what we take out. And that doesn't just mean considering, and I know it's going to contradict what I said earlier about keeping tabs. Do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself. I am massive. I contain multitudes. That's Walt Whitman for your ass. But what that means is if you're taking out of a group, be sure that you're putting in. And it's not just to make sure that community becomes sustainable, but it's for yourself because you get out what you put in. Put in the love, and you'll get the love. And it's not that you won't get the love if you don't put it in, but it's not going to be the same without you. That's the thing. It's like, look, I don't mind giving you these things, but if you're not giving me who you are, then it's not the same. And it's not a relationship then. And that's in all aspects of our life. I mean, that extends to every aspect of our life. And so that's where responsibility comes in, and that's exactly what money and markets and governments and all of that try to take away, is your ability to be responsible for yourself, your ability to be accountable to one another, and to sleep at night. You know, it's like, it's funny. I'm sure that Dick Cheney has no problem sleeping at night.
Yeah.
And I do. I have a horrible time sleeping at night. And why is that? I feel that I'm trying my hardest to be a good person, and I know he's trying his goddamnness to be fucking evil. And he sleeps at night. So it's not a matter of conscience, people. It's not a consciousness thing. That's not the battleground that we're on right now. That is a battleground, but that's not the battleground. It's not the battleground that we're on, and it's unfortunate that it's not. But I think
the whole idea of, you know, a change, a fundamental change of vision, and by vision I don't just mean ideas, I also mean action. it kind of flips a switch when we go back to the way we have been for the majority of our existence on this planet, which is a way of putting in more than we took back. The incentive to do that for the betterment of all was not something anybody talked about, because it wasn't a concept, because that's how a sustainable human community, or a sustainable animal community, okay, I won't say human community, sustainable animal community keeps going, is because fundamentally that's built into them. And the moment that we stepped outside of that, oh, I just hawked up a big old nasty loogie.
That's the invention of God, is what you're talking about right now. It's the invention,
yeah.
not the loogie, but I like that too. But the invention of God allowed people to step out of the natural cycle, the invention of God, because if there's something above you, that allows you to be above something else.
Well, and you know, I was just reading tonight where, you know, for so many years you had the state and the merchants working with the churches to assure the poor people that their way of the pyramid builders, if you will, assuring them that what they were doing was actually better than what the rich were doing, and therefore, when they got to heaven, the hierarchy would be turned upside down and they would be the rich ones. What that ensured is that those people would continue building the pyramids for the riches, quote-unquote, that they would receive in the new hierarchy where they were on top. This kind of imaginary fairy tale, and you know, I'm not an atheist. You know, I'm very much I believe in shit, and but I don't believe that I got some fucking white boss waiting to kick my ass after I die.
Right,
and
so nobody with a shotgun sitting on a cloud with looking to pick your ass off. I mean, that exists. That exists in real life.
Yes,
that
for
exists
sure,
in the
dude.
Streets of Pittsburgh, but that doesn't exist in the soulful metaphysical world.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, of course, is that doesn't exist at Naropa University.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is there are no cops killing people on the streets of Ken Wilber's neighborhood, you motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's when we break down our system and distort things that are natural fundamentals to any animal community, and we break that down and we compartmentalize it, we remove ourselves from it. And we do invent concepts like God. You know, God is a very masculine word and implies a masculine person and implies a human and implies that even in heaven we still got a boss. And what those metaphors serve to do is reinforce the meme that civilization must be protected at all costs, that what we have achieved in this, if you can say something like achievement, is you can't improve upon it, it's the best we're going to do, and to go back to a more sustainable, there is no other sustainable, this is it.
Right.
And even at our own peril, at the death of ourselves and the planet, we must protect it at all costs. And
I think it's important, too, to note something about those human constructs of documents of control, such as the Bible or television, things like that. That a quick story. In Poland during the war, a factory was forced to stop creating products that were used within their community and start putting in the explosive implements into the bombs that were going to be dropped by the Nazis. And these workers decided collectively that they would not put in these things, but appear that they were, and instead they put notes inside of the bombs. So the bombs would not explode, they would just fall and land and plant themselves into the ground. And there are still some of these bombs planted into the ground and left that way as a reminder of this fact that I'm going to state. The notes said simply, "You have friends on the other side." And
wow.
And those bombs are still planted there for a reason, just as that Bible is still relevant. Because while there's those systems of control in the Bible, Jesus still turned the tables. And while there's still that pie-in-the-sky hierarchy of the meek will inherit the earth, there's still the Garden of Eden. Those things were left in the Bible, and those things were put in the Bible, I believe, by radical elements who were undermining the authority of those who were going to use the Bible in an authoritative manner. Just as we see the TV show The Lone Gunman talking about a 9/11 theory months before 9/11, and the show is turned off and taken off the air, even though it was wildly popular, they completely laid out the entire hypothesis of 9/11 on this TV show. Just as we see Jericho, just as we see other things that do slip in through the cracks, radical elements are there. You have friends on the other side. Never forget that. And that's not to say you have friends on the front line of the police force, but that's also not to say that there's not somebody in there on your side. And when the time is relevant, those people will make themselves apparent. I guarantee that. But in the meantime, just rest safe knowing that we have friends on the other side. Now, and that's not saying that we have friends in the ranks of the enemy. That's saying that just remember that you're not alone, that the fight is universal. I think that's so very important. And that also means pay attention. Pay the fuck attention. Because you're going to fall for a cult of personality like Alex Jones. And that's no different than falling for the cult of personality of Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh. That's
or Stefan Molyneux.
Or Stefan Molyneux. Absolutely. And just remind yourself, though, that you got friends on the other side. And fight like fucking hell right now. But use the tools that we have. Use them. Use every single fucking one of them before they're not available anymore. Because they're not going to be available anymore. And if you're a peace-loving, nonviolent person who does not want to ever resort to violence, you better goddamn be using your peace-loving nonviolence in the streets. And that leads me to the last thing I want to talk about and give you the rest of the show to close out, is solidarity and what that means. Those police beat students down on the campus of University of Pittsburgh. Students who were just there being students. And in solidarity with that, and for other very apparent causes that they lay out, UC Berkeley was occupied and UC Santa Cruz was occupied. I'm not sure what other schools at this point have been occupied, but I'm sure that there are more. That's a solidarity action. If people want to be in solidarity or show their support for what happened in the streets of Pittsburgh, what the police did to those people, they want to denounce those actions, the best way is to go down and stand outside of your police station with a sign that says, "I denounce the violence of this organization." And get your comrades and get people you don't know. Tell people at the coffee shops, "We need to stand up now." And you might have 3 people doing it and you might feel stupid, but that's solidarity. Solidarity is risking stupidity for what is right. You know, I'll risk stupidity. I will risk ignorance and I will risk foolishness with the payout of knowing that I did what I could do. And so if people out there listening, you want to be in solidarity with what was going on in Pittsburgh, go down and denounce the police in general. Don't just denounce police violence. Denounce the police and see how long you can stand out there. And you'll feel good. I promise you will. I promise you, you will.
And, well, I'm going to go ahead and close out. Thanks so much for sticking around and being on the show. Rabble was pretty tired when when we talked earlier, and, you know, he was going to just take a nap and chill, and I'm happy that you stuck around so long. And I want everybody to know that over the next couple of weeks, I know NWO 411, you were asking more about G20 stuff. We're going to be talking about G20 a lot over the next few weeks, even as more and more stories emerge about everyone's experiences there. So that we're not done talking about it. We're going to keep talking about it because it was very, very important. And my message to everybody, and you know, I thanks for everybody for listening to me and listening to us talk and being involved in the dialogue, even if you fuckers didn't call us, no hard feelings. Live your life in freedom. Look for every moment of your life right now, even while you're sitting at your computer, and just think about all the areas of your life that are free and that are free from class restrictions, that are free from all of those things. Look at them, exploit them, embrace them into your life, and eliminate the state. Stop voting. And tune in next week for poet. What's his name, Rabble, real quick?
Oh, David Meltzer, Michael Rosenberg, and Terry. I'm sorry, Terry. I can't remember your last name right now. But they'll be joining us. They're anarchist poets of the old school kiln. David is an old beat poet from the way back in the 50s. And he's David said to me at a coffee shop when he was here last year that even though he can't move his legs, he feels confident enough that when the time comes, he can still pick up a brick. And David's a bad motherfucker. So everybody listen in. And they're going to be going on tour nationwide. That's why we're having them on the show at a Rush Space next week, because that's the kickoff of their nationwide tour. And I guarantee they're going to come to an area close enough for you to go see them. So listen in to these people. They're fucking amazing. And I'm pleased as punch to be working with them in New York, and I get to see my lovers in New York as well. So, yeah.
Well, awesome. We're down to our last couple of seconds, so thanks again, everybody, for listening and for hanging out in the chat room with us, and we will see you again next week. This has been Bottom Up Radio News Network, living free and signing out. Good night, everybody.